Welcome to The Lost Debate, a show for political eclectics. I'm Ravi Gupta, and today I'm welcoming back Brad Hargreaves, who is the founder and chairman of Common, which offers convenient, friendly, shared homes. And he previously co-founded General Assembly, which he sold for, I think, $1 gazillion last time I read. Some good people over there. He also sits on several boards, including Loftium, Playcrafting, At the Table. He writes a wonderful newsletters and has a podcast called Thesis Driven, where he gets great guests, but he really dives deep into real estate, which is what we're here to talk about today. There is a lot happening in the real estate market. And also for the audience, at the back end of this episode, we have a really interesting interview with Alicia Gordon, who did a poll of Black mothers, basically asking, you know, Black single mothers, like, what do they want out of our education and political system? So we will get there when we get there. But Brad, we had you on almost exactly a year ago to talk about SVB. How you been, brother?
I'm doing great. Thanks so much for having me here.
Well, 1 year later, deposits are safe, so we can move on to other topics. It's wild to think that's been a year. You wrote like a couple weeks ago, I think it was in February, about this National Association of Realtors legal melee. For our audience, there has been quite a lot of action here, and I'll give a quick summary before we take a step back. The National Association of Realtors is an organization that sets the guidelines for home sales for decades now, agreed to settle a series of lawsuits by paying $418 million in damages and eliminating its rules on commissions, among other things. This is a big deal, but before we talk about the implications of that, what is this organization?
Simply put, they're a trade association for the real estate brokers of America. There's about 1.6 million real estate agents that hold real estate licenses in the United States, and the vast majority of them are represented by the National Association of Realtors, or more accurately, by a local chapter of the National Association of Realtors. The NAR also does one very important thing, which is really important to this settlement. They run what's called a multiple listing service, or an MLS, which is, there's a bunch of different MLSs for different markets in the United States. And the MLS is the source of truth for real estate listings, and more relevantly, for realtor commissions. So that gets really important as we get into this topic.
And this National Association of Realtors, they had been kind of like the mafia of residential real estate in this country. But also, like the mafia, it seems like they've had better days. Even before this, you know, even outside of this particular lawsuit, it seems like it's been rather turbulent over there.
Yeah. So when writing this article for Thesis Driven, I went through and made a list of all of the things that have happened to the National Association of Realtors, the NAR, over just the past 9 months. And it's really extraordinary. It started back in last summer, when their president was forced to resign, various accusations of impropriety, not going to get into that. Their next president actually then had to resign due to blackmail on a personal matter, which, wild. And they've also had judgment after judgment come against them, some of them more financial in nature. So the one case that until recently a lot of people were paying attention to was the Sitzer Burnett case, which levied initially the judgment was $3 billion against NAR for price fixing, basically requiring that agents charge a certain amount, which was found to be an antitrust issue. That's illegal collusion. You can't do that. So huge judgment there. And then about 3 months ago, the Department of Justice threw out a previous settlement of a different lawsuit, and this is actually the bigger one, NoSelec, that said that you can't put guarantees of buyer compensation, buyer agent compensation, sorry, in the MLS. This gets a little complicated, but basically the point is sellers' agents have historically been the ones who pay buyer's agents. You know, someone looking to buy a home doesn't have to fork over tens of thousands of dollars to pay their agent. So it's pretty simple and straightforward that if you're a buyer, you want someone representing you, it's basically free because their commission is being paid out of the seller's commission. Now, the DOJ came along and said, you can't do that. You can't have blanket promises of commission from seller's agents to buyer's agents. Now, there's some subtlety there. There's some nuance, but that seems to be the outcome of it. And this big settlement that happened last week really locks in that decision that, you know, you no longer can have buyer's agent compensation listed on the MLS, which most people believe will lead to a situation where buyers have to pay their own agents. And there's a lot of skepticism that buyers will actually do that.
Well, before we get there, just to paint the picture of what the market is like right now, right? So I've both bought and sold apartments and houses over the past 10 years. And, you know, as you mentioned, right now, and correct me if I'm wrong on these numbers, it's 3 and 3 in the U.S., right? So it tends to be
give or 3% take, commission.
Yeah. So I just bought a place in Brooklyn last year. The overall commission on it was 6% paid by the seller. And as you mentioned, the buyer is kind of like, almost like the way that we in the healthcare market is almost immune from the sort of market effects of that particular market. So they're just going to automatically sign up for a realtor because it's not really on them. But the critique of this, and this is both a right and left wing critique of that, is that, well, the cost is baked in eventually to the price. So the buyer is paying for it ultimately downstream, because if I turn around and sell my apartment, I'm going to take into account that 6% commission. So if I'm trying to decide, oh, I now have this place, I'm thinking about selling it or not, I'm going to bake into that the fact that I've got to pay the 6% commission. It may, number one, it may make it less likely that I sell, because that's a huge tax on selling my property. But two is, if I do sell, I may sell it for more to try to recoup that commission.
Absolutely. It's got to come out of somewhere. You know, ultimately, and I believe Spencer Raskoff, founder of Zillow, said this really well, that ultimately the buyer pays for it, because only one person brings a check to the closing, and it's the buyer. So ultimately, this 6%, even though the buyer is not directly paying for it, they're paying for it.
I saw this somewhere. It might have been the New York Times write-up about this. I didn't realize this, but we're kind of an outlier internationally. Our commissions are way higher in the U.S. on average than most of our counterparts.
Yes, and the argument there is that the NAR is much stronger than its international comps, and therefore they've been able to maintain much higher commissions. And the DOJ and the plaintiffs of these cases would argue they've been able to maintain that due to collusion. And that kind of collusion is against antitrust law in the United States, and the courts seem to agree with them.
And so, okay, you alluded to the world after this, and we can kind of bundle together both this sort of major ruling on the commissions with the listing reform that will come in here. But in your post, you talked about potential, you know, next steps here. You know, one is one-off deal making, one is retainers, like in terms of what could happen now on the buyer side. So one-off deal making, meaning like you actually can negotiate with the real estate company now as to what commission they charge retainers, hourly, just to pay people for their time helping you, lower cost competitors, and then my favorite, which is unbundled services, which is certainly what I would do if I were buying now, which is I would pay a lawyer and I'd probably do most of the legwork myself to avoid that 3%. Especially you're talking about a place like New York, people are buying apartments for $1 million, $2 million, more than that, depending on where you live. Like 3% is a lot of money, you know. Which of those do you think is the most likely scenario next, or which combination?
Well, I would start with a bit of a caveat, which is there's still a lot of unanswered questions here. And there's actually a lot of problems that this judgment raises. So I was talking with one broker yesterday about the settlement, and he was like, hey, a lot of our buyers are VA loan recipients. And actually, if you're a VA loan recipient, you are prohibited from paying a buyer commission. So now if seller's agents can't pay a buyer commission, VA loan recipients are prohibited from paying a buyer commission. Does that just mean that everyone taking a VA loan is going to be unrepresented in a real estate deal? Well, that's crazy. So there's a lot of these like weird problems that haven't quite been worked out yet. And it's also important to remember, this is a settlement. This is not a finalized deal. The last settlement, remember, got thrown out by the DOJ. And they reopen this whole thing. Now, this settlement looks a lot more like what the DOJ wants, So most smart people are assuming that this one will come through. But it's not set in stone yet. So the first question they have to ask is, well, are buyers willing to pay their own agents? And if so, how much? You know, it seems unlikely to me, although it's a matter of debate. Are buyers going to say, hey, you know, we believe in the value of the service. We're just going to pay, you know, the 3% that we would have paid otherwise, but we're going to pay it ourselves. I don't know. That seems unlikely to me. But it's a matter of debate. The next is, do you see some kind of, which I think is the most likely, a stratification of service layers, more fixed fee payments, and I think unbundling is a part of that as well. You're going to see some like really light touch services where basically there is an AI tool that is connecting a buyer to properties and helping them, you know, through some of the process. You're going to see lawyers play a greater role here. Not just kind of doing the final paperwork, but actually maybe helping people through the buy process. So I think you're going to see kind of a Cambrian explosion of different tools, different models to help buyers get over the finish line. And I think you're also going to see higher end buyer representation services that use a very similar version of the model. So why would I hire a buyer's agent if I'm a buyer? Well, if that buyer's agent can show me properties that I'm not going to find on Zillow, things that are off market, things I might not otherwise see, which is what investment sales brokers are already doing, you're going to see a lot more of that as well in the residential side.
I mean, it's such an interesting point because right now the competition is stifled. Obviously, that is the assumption that underlies all of this activity. But the way that competition is hindered is interesting because right now the competition that exists is between Compass and Berkshire Hathaway and yada yada for that 3% commission. Now, what could be interesting now is that Compass is competing with itself now. If they have a customer, I could be a 1% customer. I could be a 3% customer. I could be 5 hours. I could be 20 hours. Now they have more of an incentive potentially in this world to upsell me on all sorts of stuff because it's like we'd be breaking the mold, which in some ways could lead to an explosion of innovation. I know you think not just as a policy guy, but as a entrepreneur who started a bunch of successful businesses. Like in your head, what would, you know, maybe this is giving away too much of the secret sauce, but what are some of the interesting angles from a business perspective that you think are going to like be really successful here? You mentioned one already when it comes to like sort of the AI side of things.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly think tools that help buyers, retail buyers, find homes, do the project management of homes, of their home search process, get a little bit early into the negotiation process, perhaps, of buying a home. I think there's a big place for those tools. I think there are also going to be interesting opportunities to help agents, help brokers find off-market deals, find unique opportunities, help maintain that relationship that they have with the buyer now that they really have to compete against a wider set of things for those commissions. So I think there's going to be some really interesting opportunities come out of this. I also think the next big battle is that, remember, the NAR is not the only organization thinking about real estate agents' interests. A lot of states highly regulate real estate brokers and that ecosystem. And there's going to be a lot of pushback from state-level regulators on probably some of the low-cost self-help alternatives we're going to see. Because remember, the fact that you need a license and you are regulated as a real estate broker, that is not enforced by NAR. NAR helps with that, but that is enforced by state governments. You can't just come out and call yourself a broker without a license and start helping people buy homes. Like, that's illegal. And you're going to see a really interesting battle between some of these state regulatory agencies and, I believe, some of the models that are going to emerge after this judgment.
I have this sort of loose feeling about New York that they make it very hard to not use a real estate agent. And I've always been baffled by that because it's like a lawyer is going to make sure I'm not buying something that's not real, right? So I already have that under control. why am I told I have to use a real estate agent? Now, I've had some wonderful real estate agents. Shout out to Aaron Mazur over at Compass. He's done a lot of work for me before. Love him. But like, I do find it weird that the government's telling me I have to use this licensed service. And like, it seems like they regulate the licenses almost like a cartel does, or at least within their own. Like, they kind of self-police.
Well, I will defend real estate agents for a moment, not necessarily the 6%, but like, they are trained mediators of the market. And one of the main areas they're trained in is fair housing law and making sure that there is an open sale process. Fair housing law is very strict, and brokers in many ways serve partly as the mediators of that process to ensure everyone has a fair shake at buying homes that come on the market. And for most people, a home is the single biggest purchase they will make. And, you know, their wealth, their generational wealth is tied to that purchase. So having an advisor there who understands what that is and what that means and things to look for, I don't think that's earlier in the process than a lawyer typically gets involved. You know, I think there is a need for that. Is it worth? And, you know, particularly as you get into higher end homes, given where home price appreciation has gone, is it worth the, you know, 6%? That's a matter of debate. I would say just one of the biggest, I think, symptoms of inefficiency in the market, which you have when something is cartelized like this, you know, you have 3.8 million homes sold in the United States last year. There were 1.6 million real estate agents. I mean, that just seems like a crazy ratio of human beings to output. Did it take 1.6 million Americans to sell 3.8 million homes? So I think one outcome of this rule will probably be more concentration of power in the best agents, in the most experienced agents who can get listings. And a lot of the marginal players, unfortunately, will probably leave the industry.
That's fascinating. And, you know, it seems like with the high interest rates and the sort of cooling of the market, it's not a great time to be a real estate agent anyway. It seems to be a part-time job for a lot of people. Although with 6% commission, if you sell low single digits houses, depending on what city you're in, that could be your entire salary. From your perspective and watching these interest rates, what's the state of the market right now? Where do you think it's going? The obvious thing that our audience knows, most people who follow this know, is that people are locked in. People with the 3% rates might want to sell their houses, but know that it's foolish to get rid of that mortgage. And so there's a lot of pent-up activity that could be unleashed if the right conditions arrived, but it's out of the hands of most people, you know? What do you think? Where do you think this goes from here?
Look, I'll caveat this and say that if I knew where rates were going, I would be trading bonds and not writing a finance newsletter. But one thing that I think has surprised a lot of people over the past 12 months with rates at an elevated level is the level of activity that is still happening. I mean, there was a lot of anticipation 12 months ago that, you know, single-family home sales were going to drop precipitously, that, you know, multifamily was going to pull back, there'd be a huge increase in cap rates, so basically a decrease in the price of multifamily assets. And that really hasn't happened nearly to the extent that people thought. And the best interpretations I've heard for that are really twofold, one on the retail side and one on the more commercial side. On the retail side, feels like there are a lot more cash buyers. There are a lot more people who are diving into the housing market with pretty scarce inventory, given that people who are locked into long-term low rates aren't selling. But home builders are doing great. I mean, as new inventory comes on, it gets sold. And so starts and permits in single family keep going up, 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 where people thought by now it was going to be crickets. That's the opposite has happened. So limited inventory, lots of cash buyers, a lot of people have cash. Retail investors have cash sitting on the sidelines. They're still buying single family homes. On the commercial side, I think people, analysts largely underestimated the impact of allocation and capital flows over yields. You see a lot of multifamily portfolios, for instance, trading for price premiums that, you know, where the yields are below the level someone could get from treasuries. And if you have a family office buyer, a high net worth individual buyer, they're like, well, that's crazy. Why would you buy a operationally intensive, risky multifamily asset for less than the yield you could get by going and buying treasuries? Well, if you're a huge pension fund, if you're an institution, and you're like, I want to take my portfolio allocation of multifamily from 35% to 45% because I'm allocating away from office, I'm allocating away from other things, you're going to go do that, and you're not going to think too much about yields when you make that allocation decision. And so you're seeing a lot of purchases out there in the market that don't seem to make sense, but they're driven by institutional players rebalancing their portfolios. So you're seeing a lot more activity there out there than I think a lot of people expected.
And you're particularly focused on small multifamily units. You think that there's kind of a market inefficiency around these and not enough attention paid to those units. Say a little bit more about that.
Yeah. So one thing we've seen over the past couple of years is are more small real estate operators, entrepreneurs going out and aggregating small multifamily portfolios. And, you know, that started to get a little bit more into the institutional segment as well. Carlyle, for instance, has been buying a lot of small multifamily buildings in the New York metro area. But these buildings kind of sit between two big institutional asset classes. On one hand, you have traditional multifamily, you know, 100, 200, 300 unit buildings. Institutions have been there for a long time. On the other hand, you have single family, where that really emerged as a proper real estate asset class 5-10 years ago. Invitation Homes started after the last after the global financial crisis. They were acquired by Blackstone. You're starting to see more institutional money go into single family homes. In the middle there, you have small multifamily buildings, you know, say 2 to 20 unit multifamily structures. They tend to be very, very diverse. It's hard to like generalize what these things are. They have very different building systems. They can be tough to source, tough to underwrite. So it's a tricky asset class, but you're starting to see more operators, more capital go after that segment. I think that's ultimately going to be a good thing for tenants because those institutions tend to have more professional management. They actually understand and follow the laws, which you often don't see with traditional legacy small multifamily landlords.
Interesting. Well, you know, you were talking about the sort of rise in inventory and or at least the sort of the boon to sort of new inventory and builders. You know, there's this movement going on. You know, we've talked to Connor Doherty at the New York Times a few times on this podcast. I'm sure you read his stuff. He just recently wrote something interesting where he went to the YIMBY Town Conference, Austin, Texas. YIMBY meaning yes in my backyard. And this traditionally has been a relatively niche movement of people who want to counter the NIMBYs, the not in my backyard people. Essentially, people, you know, the YIMBYs want more development for a number of reasons. We've covered this pretty extensively on this podcast. And what Connor found was fascinating, which is that he was like, okay, this used to be a kind of like leftist kind of niche organization. And he was like, well, Greg Gianforte, the governor of Montana, Republican governor, showed up and gave the keynote. There's Republicans all over the place in this conference. And he was like, well, there seems to be now a symmetry between the left YIMBYs and the right YIMBYs for more development. Have you picked up any of this trend? And do you think this is a real force in the years to come?
I think it's hard to look at the YIMBY movement and say that there's been any big legislative movement that has been as successful over the last 5 years. I mean, you've seen YIMBYs pass legislation in very blue states like California, where they've passed a raft of legislation that has made it easier to build housing. And you've seen successes in very red states. You know, DeSantis passed probably the most aggressive state preemption of local zoning you've seen. Gianforte, you mentioned in Montana, passed very aggressive.
Yeah.
Minnesota, the far left Minneapolis City Council passed an aggressive pro-housing reform. So this is not emerging as the left or right issue. And I think that's a good thing for housing supply. And if you look at a place like New York, you tend to have Democrats more in favor. Certain Democrats, not all Democrats, centrist Democrats, younger Democrats tend to be more in favor of pro-housing legislation. You know, you have the NIMBYs, that are kind of a mix of older Democrats who were, you know, elected and grew up in an environment where, you know, a housing shortage was not an issue. It was almost inconceivable in the 1970s for New York to have a housing shortage. To Staten Island Republicans, Long Island Republicans, that are very opposed to any new housing in their areas. And, you know, and then you look at red states, and it's a really interesting combination of, you know, alliance of young urban liberals and property rights Republicans. And I think Montana was brilliant in how they pursued this and saying, you know, we don't want California style zoning here. And so therefore you should be able to build multifamily structures on any residential lot, ADUs, like everything. And I thought it was a brilliant framing. And
it was a great detail tucked into that Connor's article where he talked about Montana and how the sort of free market Republican group that pushed the housing deregulation was dealing with a perception that housing deregulation, zoning changes that are traditionally done in the name of equity and all that. And that was like cancer to like the Montana politics. So what they did was they reframed it and started showing images of the frontier times and how everybody's on top of each other. And they all this kind of diverse usage of land and there was density and all of this. And basically you'd be like, hey, if you want like the Yellowstone style, like back in the day, kind of like gold mining town motif here, this is what it was about. This is what the pull yourself up by your bootstraps free marketeers are all about. I thought it was such a brilliant framing.
Well, there's this notion that the best way to preserve natural land is to actually build denser cities and to build denser towns, because the worst for the environment is if you turn everything into the suburbs and people sprawl out over hundreds of square miles. And you know, that is destructive, and that, you know, you don't have great natural landscapes in that world. You have cookie cutter homes, and some people want that, and that's fine. I don't think we should make that illegal, but we certainly shouldn't subsidize it, and we certainly shouldn't mandate it. And lately, we've been subsidizing it and mandating it and making the dense urban center illegal, the kind of dense urban center you had in a lot of, you know, 19th century city development. So, you know, the other day on, you know, the Thesis Driven show, we had on Jan Schrammeck, who is the CEO of California Forever. He's, you know, there's a big kerfuffle about 9 months ago when the New York Times leaked his plans. He had been backed by about $1 billion from, you know, Mark Andreessen.
Yeah, that was Connor also, by the way.
Yes, that was, exactly.
That's Connor's article. So yeah. He's busy, so, Connor. Yeah.
So we actually went to Jan and said, like, okay, well, tell us about what you're doing. And he came on our show and talked about, like, he's going to build a dense urban core that eventually could hold up to 400,000 people, but he bought enough land where that only has to be a third of the landholding and the rest can be open space and, like, deed-restricted open space. And that's kind of going back to the type of town development we had before the automobile, which, frankly, has a lot of benefits in terms of, you know, health and wellness, has a lot of benefits in terms of, you know, natural space preservation, the environment. And I'm a big supporter of what he's doing. I think he's going about it in a great way.
Yeah, I'm so fascinated to see what he does down there. I was thinking of sending over to him. I've been writing a lot about, like, the school I would start, you know, because I used to be a school principal and superintendent of a charter network. And I've been doing a lot of sort of pie in the sky thinking. I was thinking of just emailing him my plan and be like, hey, I'll go start that school for you over there. The problem is I don't want to be a dog who caught the car. I'm not sure I'm ready to start that school right now. But okay, one last piece here. And this is a very, I admittedly, very niche kind of question, but this is something you'll appreciate. Hopefully our audience will too. Tell me about single-stair multifamilies and why they're important.
This is one of my more niche law bugaboos, is that the U.S. differs from Europe and Asia in our building code in some pretty fundamental ways. One of those ways is that, and it seems very subtle, but it actually has huge implications, is that pretty much everywhere outside the United States and Canada, you can build up to 6 stories with one staircase. And in the US, you can only go up to 3 stories. In Canada, 2 stories. That has huge implications on how we design buildings. So if you need 2 staircases, staircases take up a lot of room. So now suddenly a small building doesn't make any sense. If you're going to build a multifamily building, you need it to be pretty big, and you need those 2 staircases to be connected by a hallway, since every unit has to be able to access both staircases. And that means that leads to the kind of design of residential building we have today. So it means most units only get light and air on one side, since the other side is the hallway and the other 2 sides are other apartments. So it's a traditional kind of double-loaded corridor format for a multi-family building you have. In Europe, that is not normal. In Europe, you have something called point access blocks. Those are basically, you walk in, you walk up the staircase or up the elevator, and you are pretty much at your apartment. So you get these like very small buildings, and you can have many of these small buildings in a row. There's a ton of benefits to that. It's much cheaper to build. A lot of people would say it's more attractive versus like a big mass. You also have better light and air in a lot of the units, and you can make bigger units more easily. Now, the argument has always been, well, that's less safe. There's only one means of egress. Well, they have lower fire death rates by a lot than the United States. The US is a pretty bad outlier in terms of structure fires. And if you dig into that, the reason is that the US, like pretty much all structure fire deaths in the United States happen in either commercial buildings or more frequently, old wood frame single family homes, you know, that were built before sprinklers, probably don't have even smoke alarms, working smoke alarms, are not built from non-combustible materials. It is very, very rare, incredibly rare, to have deadly fires in modern, sprinklered, multifamily apartment buildings that are built using non-combustible materials, fire-rated doors, have a professionally maintained smoke alarm system, etc. So we are fundamentally changing our building design for something without really any proven safety benefits. And so there's been increasingly a movement over the past, I would say really accelerating over the past 6 to 12 months to legalize 4, 5, and 6 story single stair structures.
Is there anywhere where it's passed? And is there any federal law standing in the way? It's all local?
It's state level, typically. And there's a big battle in Colorado right now. I believe there's a battle in Washington state as well. So there's a number of fights ongoing right now on the single stair issue. Washington, I think, might be close, but it's still very early in terms of the YIMBY arc.
This was wonderful. Plug your work. I mean, you have such a great newsletter for housing. I mean, I just don't know another newsletter that's as thorough as yours. And you come at it from the policy and the entrepreneurial perspective. So plug everything you're working on.
Thanks, man. So we launched Thesis Driven about a year ago, really to do these deep dives into fundamental issues at the intersection of the real estate industry, the future of cities, built world. So we touch on new financing models. We touch on weird legal changes like the NAR settlement. We touch on policy a lot. We're going to be writing about going back to the single stair issue, basically talking about fire departments this coming week. And, you know, why are fire departments often, you know, aligned against broader urban policies like road diets, bus lanes, bike lanes, et cetera. So we write about all this intersection of real estate industry, politics, policy, and finance. We also just launched a podcast where we have on people thinking about these exact things. We had John Schrammeck from California Forever, Marianne Gilmartin, who's a wonderful developer who built New York Times Tower, Barclays Center, talking about what ails New York. And just recently, Dan Doktoroff, who's the founder of Sidewalk Lab. So would love anyone to check it out at thesisdriven.com.
All right, my friend. Thank you very much.
Robbie, thanks so much for having me on.
I'm excited to welcome on the podcast Alicia L. Gordon, who's a teacher, faith leader, social strategist. She is the founder and executive director of The Current Project, which is a nonprofit organization committed to closing the social and economic gaps for Black single mothers. Prior to The Current Project, she served as the executive minister of programs at the historic Riverside Church in New York City, an institution that looms large in my hometown. Alicia, welcome to the podcast. So before we get to this amazing report that you put out about Black single mothers, how does somebody from Decatur, Georgia wind up an executive minister at Riverside?
Oh, man, the trajectory, the arc. So, yes, originally from Decatur, Georgia, grew up working class Black family. And when I went to Spelman, I was a first generation college student. I went to Spelman. I had these really big dreams of becoming a journalist. I wanted to move to New York City and live in a Brooklyn brownstone, you know, just like living single. Like many folks wanted to come to New York and start this life. And I would learn that I was pregnant with my daughter just 2 months shy of graduation. And I remember sitting on a bench on Spelman's campus, crying my eyes out because I'm 21 years old. I look down at my tote bag that's on the ground, and there's an application for like the University of Maryland at College Park peeking out the top. It's very like, you know, a whole scene out of a movie. And I remember saying to myself, well, that shit's never going to happen, right? And it's this very Genesis origin story of over the next decade, really trying to put the pieces of my life back together to reclaim the dream that I had to be a journalist and a storyteller, but also being faced with what a lot of Black single mothers face, the kind of red tape that happens when you're trying to get social safety net, when you're trying to access things like childcare, when you're trying to put food on the table, when you're trying to pursue your own dreams. We tell people to go back to school and earn degrees and do all of these things, but I was being hitting up against all of these walls over the course of a decade. And as fate would have it, that daughter that I had is now a sophomore at Spelman.
Oh, and my so goodness. This kind of full You're too young circle for that. Story. You look too young for that to be true. Well, congratulations, man, congratulations on that.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. Amazing. And so she's now at Spelman. You've been in New York City for a while. You wind up at Riverside.
I wind up at Riverside. And so I take what my friends often call these quantum leaps. In 2016, I moved to New York. I'm working for the Methodist Church. I kind of get poached from the Methodist Church in 2019 and end up at Riverside. I'm there, executive minister programs in the, you know, the most prominent church in America. And then I make another strange, unexpected pivot into politics. I started working for Michael Bloomberg's presidential campaign. And it was at that time where I'm bringing like this kind of social advocacy, this faith-based lens, and now going behind the veil in the political world to really understand how policy is made, who's making those decisions around policy. And that thread through is actually how we end up at the current project, because we are trying to solve for how do we close the social and economic gap for Black single mothers and how do we bring lived experience into that process. But also the overarching and long-term arc is how do we make the case for policy change? Because programming is programming is programming, but when we put folks back into communities that can't sustain the thriving, all of that is the result of a lack of good policy that actually sustains folks. So that's how we got here. That's the connection to my story and the work.
In setting the context for this, for the audience, this constituency we talk about, Black single mothers, I can only, you know, talk about my personal experience here, which is I started a charter school in North Nashville, which had and probably still has the highest incarceration rate of Black males in the entire country. The flip side of that was that there are a whole lot of Black single mothers in North Nashville. They were my constituency in my school. It was by far most of my students were raised by Black single mothers or grandmothers, or in the case mm-hmm. of certain families, great grandmothers.
Mm-hmm. Aunties, all that good stuff.
Yeah. And this is a group of people who, on average, are shouldering a lot of the burden and are in many ways distressed and forgotten in our politics. And so you decide that one of the sort of seminal pieces of work that you're going to put out there into this world is a survey of Black single mothers. You know, how wide did you cast the net, and how did you even figure out who to talk to for this project?
Yeah. That's a great question. So we surveyed 504 middle to low income Black single mothers across the country. The threshold was identifying mothers that we have coined as Middler moms, M-I-D-D-L-E-R. These Middler moms are mothers who are out earning social safety net, but they're under earning to economically thrive. And so when we think about this kind of safety net runway that families often can rely on, these Middler moms actually are left outside of that threshold, and they're really trying to figure out the pieces of their lives, even though on paper, they say they make too much money to qualify. But we all of the data shows that they actually don't have enough money to make ends meet. And so by year two and a half or year three of running this organization, that was something that I knew to be true because that was my lived experience. When I moved to New York in 2016, I went from making like $19,000 a year as a graduate assistant at Emory with an eight-year-old to moving to New York City and making $80,000 a year. And I remember calling my mom and being like, oh my gosh, I'm making so much money. And then I got taxed by the federal, state, and living on the island of Manhattan. I suddenly had to...
This is your example of the famous Cosby Show episode where Bill Cosby is giving the Monopoly money to Theo and then he takes it one piece at a time back and he's like, taxes,
you know, food. Baby, taxes.
He's like, do you plan to eat?
right. But I mean, that's what it was. I went from rent being $650 a month for a two-bedroom in Decatur to $2,500 a month in New York City. I went from not paying for health insurance because I was on state insurance through that safety net program to having to pay $450 a month for a family of two, right? And so on paper, though I was out earning social safety net, I really was not in a place of economic thriving, right? And so it was this kind of lived experience and what I was hearing from the anecdotal stories of mothers that are in our program, that this was a real thing. But it's one thing for me to say it. It's another thing to actually have the data for it. So, you know, we were able to get some funding to do this national data survey. To our knowledge, to this point, is groundbreaking and might be first of its kind, right? To ask literally 4.2 million Black single mothers in this country and really taking a portion of them and trying to get a snapshot of what their lived experiences are. And what we have found is that these Mittler moms, 73% of respondents said that they are part of this Mittler community. They are making too much money on paper to qualify for social safety net, but they're still feeling the strain of not thriving economically. And so that was really this kind of feeling, this unction, this Black mother knowing that there were other mothers out there. And what we've seen since this data has been out for the last 5 or 6 weeks is people are like, oh, this is a real thing. And what the data has shown us is that Black single mothers really have this kind of innate power as a voting bloc, as a constituency, as people who have been left out of the conversation. But when you think about the thriving of communities and the responsibility that Black single mothers have in that, making sure that children get to school, right, that they're ready to learn and fed and all those things, the level of power that Black single mothers have is one to really be reckoned with.
Yeah, and just to paint a sort of demographic picture here, so 3/4 work, a plurality have some level of college education. They have a pretty significant portion of them, 20% have a child, an adult child still living at home. 7 in 10 have children attending traditional public schools. That's a good place to pause. What did we learn about how Black single mothers view their educational opportunities and what do they want out of the system?
It's really interesting. And I appreciate you raising those data points because what the data points do is two things. One, it really interrupts the longstanding narrative that Black single mothers are irresponsible and wayward and all these things. But it also interrupts that we are not deeply invested in the academic success and well-being of our children. As you said, 49% of these mothers live across the South. 73% of them are working, but 66% of them are making less than $50,000 a year. But the thing that I want to correlate to your question about, you know, the deep interest in the academic part is that you have this almost 70% of these respondents have some kind of college degree or college experience, right? So it's not lost on me when you look at the data around public school choice, that they are deeply interested in the academic well-being of their children. It's a natural correlation. It's no different than me holding 2 degrees. And of course, I'm interested in making sure that my daughter has access to these kind of academic things. So the correlation, so what this data really does is interrupt these narratives, especially when you talk about local schools, traditional schools, you talk about things like school choice, which is a big part of this data about student and parent involvement, is that overwhelmingly that Black single mothers are deeply invested in what's happening with their children in their academic classrooms.
And what do we learn about school choice? You know, you mentioned school choice. How do these families view the concept of school choice?
Overwhelmingly, Black single mothers feel positively about school choice. And I know that the conversations around school choice can really be politicized, right? When you're talking about vouchers, when you're talking about ESAs, when you're talking about all these things. And I think people try to loop me into some kind of political left, right, middle thing on that. But what this data really says to us is that Black single mothers see school choice as something, as a pathway for them to exercise their agency. There's probably no greater decision that a Black single mother will make in the formative years of her children's lives is where they go to school. You know what I mean? That decision and the choices that they have ripple effect for the rest of that child's life. And so what the data has shown us is that Black single mothers are interested in school choice. They want to know that they have options. But as you can see in some of the data, 50% of them said, I wish I had more information about what my school choice options are. And we have to think about, Ravi, you know, the kind of compounded things and barriers, systemic barriers that get in the way of Black single mothers having access to information, right? We think about the hours in which meetings happen. We think about sometimes they're working multiple jobs, they're juggling multiple children. There are so many things that get in their way. And so when half of the respondents were saying, I want to know about the choices that I have for my child, but I just don't know, what are the ways in which we can respond locally, local school systems, superintendents, and things of that nature to ensure that this demographic that's responsible for millions of children and their well-being in school have the information that they need to make important choices about where their children go to school.
Yeah, I mean, these education numbers are so fascinating. So more than three quarters are concerned about their children's progress, academic progress. And you ask for impressions about traditional public schools, private or faith-based school, public charter schools, and homeschooling. What's fascinating is sort of the highest performing sort of model among families, depending on how you look at the data, are the public charter schools. Like, families seem really invested in those options. And it looks like, you know, and some of this other data seems to suggest, you know, families are, 32% of families are thinking about searching for or considering a different school, and another 35% have thought about it but haven't yet decided to make a change. And so it looks like they're kind of searching for more options.
Right? Yeah. Yeah. You know, that the dissonance between those two points often comes up about, like, there is a high level of satisfaction, allegedly, right? Based on this data, that they are satisfied with where their children go to school. And then the next data point, that same amount of people are also kind of like, I'm not satisfied with my child's academic progress. And so the question always comes up, why is that? Why is there dissonance between the satisfaction about where their children are going to school, but the dissatisfaction about the academic success? And we know why, right? It's because when you are experiencing compounded stressors, when you are the sole person responsible for making decisions, when you have, there's another data point in here that talks about 74% of Black single mothers are dealing with moderate to high levels of stress, right? So when all of those things are compounded in your lived and day-to-day experience, what you know to be true is one thing. What you actually have the capacity to do to change it is a whole nother thing, right? And so that talks about the role and responsibility of local community, of folks who are in proximity to Black single mothers. We think about the numbers of employers who hire Black single mothers who are often working as secretaries or working as support staff and all those different things, how those people are also have a role in ensuring that they have capacity, right, in their thoughts and their beings and their well-being to be able to say, I know this to be true. Now, what is it? How do I begin to make different choices for my child? How do I build the capacity for that? And so I think the data points us in a direction to not only solve for X when it comes to things around school choice, but it also gives us some nuance about why these the dissonance between some of the stats are happening. And those are the things that we solve for through policy, right? Those are the things that we solve for when we think about child tax credit or the federal poverty line and all of those kind of things that really help people get into a place of social and economic thriving.
You know, there's something interesting you said when you talked about some of this data, which is you framed it in terms of agency. And I think it's an interesting use of language, because so often at the level of policy debates, when we talk about, you know, I just participated in a debate about whether Democrats should support certain versions of school choice, it's always framed in terms of like technocratic terms, like what are the results, yada, yada, yada. But I think for a lot of parents, yes, they're concerned about results, of course, but they're making a moral argument about I deserve the ability to choose between a series of options, as many options as possible, and I deserve it, regardless of whatever like arguments you can make about dollars and cents or results or regulation, et cetera. I deserve this. So tell me a little bit about it. It seems to me, correct me if I'm wrong, that parents, of course, are looking at this to say, all right, I want effective options, et cetera. But they're also, it seems like they're framing this in almost like what you'd say, like philosophical terms to say, like, this goes beyond a policy argument.
You know, listen, as a person of faith, I can't help but, lean into this question of morality, right? I am of the belief that when those who are in the margins, those who, whatever that marginalization may be, and I mean real marginalization, not the ones that people often imagine in their heads, but when those people are in a place of thriving, it lifts everyone else up just by sheer social universal math, right? And there has to be a moral call to see not just buzzwords around equality, not just buzzwords around, how do we level the playing field, but when you are grounded in the moral idea that all people are worthy and deserving of social and economic thriving and holistic thriving and being well and having access to the things that make them thrive as human beings, then all of this stuff kind of gets worked out in the ways in which they should be worked out. But obviously, we don't live in that kind of world, right? We live in a world where racism and sexism and capitalism fuels and drives so much of our decision making. And even those of us who are who oppose that type of structure, we still have to play in it, right? in order to make even what we're doing possible. And I actually listened to your conversation with Benjamin Harrell the other day.
Oh, yeah.
And it was such a good conversation. And when there was something that, that you all brought up that almost settles into this conversation we're having about the balance between policy and politics and this kind of moral mandate, where you guys were talking about residential choice. Residential choice being school choice and being able to choose where you live is really the kind of the first line of defense in choosing where one goes to school, 100%. And what happens when you don't have the leverage to make that choice, right? What are the kind of innate systemic things that prohibit people from literally making choices about where they get to live? And when we pull the lens back, really being able to understand that even on the lever of choosing where people get to choose where they live, you think about all of the ripple effects as a result, the lack of access to fresh food, the living in a food desert, not having access to after school programs, not having access to the right schools, like so many things rest upon even that one entry point around where we get to live. And so when we begin to ask these kind of nuanced questions, when we begin to interrogate our political leanings and social leanings and even our own lived experiences, it allows us to have a fleshier conversation about what the resolve is. It begins to help us to have a fleshier conversation and put some meat on the bone, exactly to what you said earlier about people want results and they want the data, but sometimes the data and the results and getting to the resolve is often where it all falls apart. And that's because we often are in these different leaning states of morality. And so I appreciate that conversation between you and Benjamin because I was like, ooh, residential choice.
Yeah, it is the primary method of school choice. We don't call it that. Okay. I would be remiss if I didn't ask you about politics, given that we're in 2024. And 76% of those you surveyed plan to vote. Most of them say they will definitely vote. The majority of them are Democrats, although they do believe that the country's heading in the wrong direction. And there's probably a little bit more favorability of the Republican Party than people would assume, although it's kind of closely in line with what the sort of historic numbers have been for Republicans. But there are kind of three options for Democrats right now when it comes to a key constituency like Black single mothers. Number one is that they vote for Democrats. That's what the Democrats want. That's historically has been very critical for Democrats' victories. Two is that Democrats hemorrhage some of this support to Donald Trump and Republicans, which would be a disaster for Democrats. Three is that this constituency is uninspired and stays home, which is also a disaster for Democrats. As you look at the data and, you know, obviously intuitively based on your understanding of the situation, what do you think this sort of next 6 months is going to hinge on for Democrats and Republicans as they try to motivate this key constituency?
Black women in general, obviously, we have historically always voted. We, you know, overwhelmingly vote. It is a part of our democratic and cultural duty to do so. And I think that, you know, the Democrats have taken, you know, I think they think that that's always going to happen. What we have seen as a result of this data and highlighting Black single mothers, Black Black single mothers. There's another data report that's actually not out yet. You're probably really the first person I'm saying this to. We haven't put it out yet, but we started putting some pieces of data together to try to identify how many of the 4.2 million Black single mothers in this country fall into this Mittler gap. These mothers who are somewhat educated, who are working, who have two children or less, you know, who are really in this place of one decision away into a place of economic thriving. And our very early estimates, over half are falling into that group when you think about the larger Black single mother. And so when you think about the extraction of Black single mothers and the voting bloc and the voting power that they have, it's really unfortunate that the Democratic Party has not been more strategic about not only how they engage Black women voters, but really see the opportunity here in 2024 through data reports like this, where you have this contingency of folks who understand the power of agency, right? They understand that even with these compounded stressors, that they have some kind of civic and social duty to community, but also, as you said, teetering. Some may go ahead and vote it out of ancestral responsibility. But I would often, the conversations that I've been having with a lot of Black single mothers, and our data affirms this, 91% of them are dealing with inflation and rising cost of living. 91%. And I think that for many of the in this particular group, they are fed up. They have reached their limit. And they have found ways to circumvent policy and circumvent politics and circumvent the talking points of politicians and work within community, the community that they've built for themselves to get their particular needs met. And so there's an opportunity here. We still got a lot of runway to go until we get to November, but I'm not going to paint a rosy picture as if like, oh, Black single mothers are going to go out and vote. Black single mothers have figured out, how do I get my particular needs met? How did I use the power and agency I have in a very localized way to move the needle for my life and the life of my children? And I would venture to say that many of them are going to hang their hat on that versus trying to hang their hat on a presidential election.
Yeah, what's fascinating to me is this is such a key constituency for Democrats. Yet so many Democrats oppose school choice, for example, as we talked about, which is something that these families are asking for. It just seems like, you know, to me, in looking at this, when faced with, you know, whenever the Democrats are faced with an issue that sort of they view as pitting their sort of college-educated progressives against Black and brown families who are in the sort of more middle-income side of things, or in this case, the middler, I think you call it.
Middler, yeah.
They don't always choose the right option there.
Yeah. Well, look, it says that 86% of them said they were more likely to vote for a political candidate that supports school choice. Right. And again, that's why I said earlier is that we have to remove ourselves. And I'm talking as a Democrat. We have to remove ourselves from the politicization of it. Right. That is exactly why I frame it as Black single mothers using something like school choice to exercise agency, because the exercising that working the muscle of agency to say, well, I can make a particular choice about this. And if you prohibit my ability to make a choice about this particular thing in my life, I mean, you might have problems, right? And so how do we begin to pull the lens back as a party to say, I am not going to rest my laurels on a politicized fight about this particular thing when this constituency has said that I will vote for you if you not just about school choice. We have to nuance the conversation that if you are in a position as a politician to continue to create the pathways for me to exercise the choice that I need for my life, whether it's school choice, whether it's reproductive health, whether it's access to food, whatever the choice is, right? We talked to a Black single mothers about having a choice-filled life. And so if you are a candidate that promotes me being able to make the best choices for me and my family, then there's something to talk about there. But I think that the party has to get a little more savvy. And that, you know, and that's, you know, that's one thing you can say about the Republican Party. They are savvy. They focus on what their talking points are, and they don't let up, right? And so there's a part of, I think, our engagement that we have just lost the savviness of how to really dig into new constituency, how to really build a coalition of Black single mothers. And that's what we're doing at the current project. We said, well, hell, we'll just try to build it internally and try to get Black single mothers to come alongside us around issues that matter, which is a part of the outcomes of the data report.
Alicia, this has been really great. Where can folks find your work?
Yeah, thecurrentproject.org. That's where we are online. We're The Current Project on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. And if you are a Black single mother listening to this, come join our online community, because this is where we're talking about all those things. And you can sign up for that at thecurrentproject.org.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate it.
You're so welcome. Thank you for having me.
Well, thanks, Brad. Thanks, Alicia. Two great interviews. And thank you, everybody, for listening. Remember to go out there, if you haven't yet, go on Apple or Spotify and give us that 5-star rating. Say wonderful things about us. We don't bother you with advertising right now. We don't charge you for anything. Still one thing you can do to show your appreciation for this podcast. Also, Spotify has this new feature, which is kind of cool. You can comment on individual episodes. You can ask questions or whatever. And my promise to you is if you put questions in the Spotify chats, I will answer them. You can even insult me and I will respond to you on the chat. But try to be nice. You don't have to be, but try. Voicemail is 321-200-0570. We will actually be taking a break next week. I have been podding like crazy and we are working on a very, very cool set of stuff. One is the India pod that I've been talking about. The other is a series on immigration. We've heard you love the immigration issue. And so we've been doing a deep dive on that, kind of like the Israel-Palestine stuff we did, except probably a little bit more narrative style. So we've done a ton of interviews and with experts and people affected on the ground, and we're trying to basically poke around the country to find out what's happening out there. So the downside of that is it takes a lot of effort. And so in order to do you right, we're going to take a little breather next week, but then we'll be back after that. Thank you very much, everybody.